this was one of the better ones I've seen in a while. Of course, it led me to go off and read a little bit about Werner Herzog's biography, which is amazing in and of itself.
Probably one of the best filmmakers we have.
Well, I got to go and watch Fitzcarraldo. I just do.
Fitzcarraldo is just a surreal look into the Amazon jungle, and the fact of, you know, the visuals that he puts to it and the music, and it's just it's a really clever juxtaposition. And I guess we have a connection here because Werner Herzog is one of Anthony Bourdain's favorite filmmakers.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah. So, yeah, for people who want to check it out.
Yeah, and by the way, the layover Hong Kong was really enjoyable.
I need to catch up on the layover episodes. I've seen like one or two, but.
Well, Rome was wonderful. New York was pretty fun. Miami was a hoot. Hong Kong was interesting, and I don't know what next week is. If there is a next week.
I guess it's finishing up the whole series before the year ends. I'm guessing.
But that's what I'm saying. I don't know if there is a new one next week because.
Oh.
Monday, the 26th. Yeah, there probably is. Yeah. And see, Robert in Australia, we were talking about voter registration a few minutes ago, and he said, when you turn 18 in Australia, you contact the Australian Electoral Commission, which you can do online now, or they'll contact you, and you register to vote by filling out the standard form. And that's it. You're registered to vote for life. You do need to inform them if you change address. Then all you have to do is turn up on polling day and have your name crossed off the rolls. You don't have to vote at that point, but most people do. And voting on average takes 10 minutes each election. When I turn up at the polls, they ask me my name and I tell them. Then they ask my address and I tell them that. And then I get the paper ballots to fill out. He capitalizes paper ballots. I fill them out, put them in the voting box by the door on the way out, and that's it. Most elections are decided within 3 to 4 hours of the polls closing. You see, and that's such a profound example. The difficulty of our elections is a manufactured, created, deliberate effort to keep people from doing what the thing is designed to have people do in the first place. Vote.
Well, you know, it's obvious, and I think this is the other thing, the other greatest trick that the Republicans have played, is that probably the Republicans have never, since we've been alive, Bob, since anyone listening has been alive, have been winning by or by losing by that margin. They probably have been getting their ass beat every single year since we've all been alive.
Right. If everybody goes and votes, the classic case in point. I mean, it wasn't much of a contest, but. The primary for the governor in the special election here in this state, the turnout was something around 26-27%. I think for the general election it was 32%. So 32% of the registered voters, which is in itself a smaller fraction of the whole of people eligible to vote, 32% went to the polls, and of that group, 17% chose the governor of this state. Now, this is a small state of 1.5 million people.
Right.
But that's chilling.
It's the same way I got caught that we got caught with LePage. A lot of people just thought that, oh well, you know, whatever governor we're gonna get, it's probably gonna be the same. Well, I'm sure you're learning your lesson in increments really fast.
Yeah, whatever happened to the mural in the Department of Labor, David?
I think they eventually gave into that, and it was just creating a theatrical distraction. Like, let them have their mural, and then they'll come up with something else. The Republicans are good at that. They're good at these stupid hurdles that they just put up, these distraction hurdles. And then we just get all worked up over them, and then like, oh, well, whatever. You know, we'll fix that. And then they'll come up with another one.
Oh, and by the way, I was just looking at the chat room here, and Benedict at Large, Benny in the chat room, quotes a person by the name of Corey Robin. Historically, the conservative has favored liberty for the higher orders and constraint for the lower orders. What the conservative sees and dislikes, inequality, in other words, is not a threat to freedom, but its extension. For in that extension, he sees a loss of his own freedom. And that's what and it's kind of a mercantilist view of freedom, that there's only so much freedom to go around, and the only way you can guarantee yours is by making sure someone else has less of it.
Well, you know, one of the worst things that the Republicans have done is they've turned the freedom into basically a food product. Buy your freedom now!
Oh, yeah, well, who can forget freedom fries?
Yeah, freedom fries.
Freedom toast.
And they marketed it to such a degree that it's become a gimmick, and nobody really knows the real meaning of freedom, which goes back to the original. And I'm sure you know this, Bob, because you're a historian. It goes back to having your debts paid.
Yeah, it's kind of a straight line, isn't it?
And it's been totally skewed. It's been totally distorted what freedom really means. And it's a clear sign that it's been done on purpose.
But look, you know, look at what we've heard in the last 2 years from the teabaggers and the hardliners and whatnot. They have actually argued, David, that the original means of selection of the senators, which was by appointment or election by the legislature, they've argued that we need to go back to that. That we need less voting, not more. Now, can you imagine if, let's pick out a real Lulu. How about Governor McDonnell of Virginia, who went to the Pat Robertson Draw Spunky School of Law?
Yeah.
Now, what happens if he gets to, and that right-wing repig-licked legislature there, the House of Burgesses or whatever the hell it is, what if they get to pick out the U.S. senators? Well, you know, you're going to get George Allen, for starters, and he can refer to President Obama, perhaps, as Macaca. And then you'll get some other equally insane right-winger. And nobody in the Commonwealth of Virginia had a say-so in that. But there's a whole bunch of Republicans who think that's a good idea. Ron Paul. You know, everything under the sun, everything that doesn't involve some sort of Randian, sicko, predatory capitalism is unconstitutional in the Ron Paul book. I mean, that guy's a freak. And look at what this country would be. I mean, look at what Ron Paul is as frightening a candidate as the right wing of this country has ever tendered for approval by the electorate. I mean, this guy practically thinks the Constitution is unconstitutional. If it isn't just the Randian anarcho-capitalism, he's not interested in it. Clean water, clean air? No, we don't need an EPA, he says. Children who can actually read and write after they've been to school? Nah, we don't need a Department of Education.
It's the obsession of an imaginary vision that can never come to fruition.
And I didn't realize it, but this crazy old coot is 76 years old.
Yeah, I mean, he's been running for office more times than Ralph Nader and Romney and Newt Gingrich combined.
The worst of.
And you know, I think it goes back to if we get those if we go along with Republicans, you know, Bob, we're going to have to get that that sacred holy uranium lake.
Yeah, gee. Glow in the dark.
Yeah, glow in the dark, exactly.
Hey.
Well, Bob, I'm going to leave you on this prayer meeting Wednesday and let others get their licks in.
All right, David, take care.
All right, Bob, great.
Bye
now. Bye.
And David's working himself up a Jim Dandy, little prayer meeting preacher impression. I was proud to hear that. No, you, You want to hear how creepy, crazy, cootie old Ron Paul is? He showed up on Chicken Noodle News, being interviewed by, of course, that hard-hitting investigative journalist, Piers Morgan, the only man who could make Larry King seem informed. No, it was Ali Velshi, not Piers Morgan. Ali Velshi caught him out by asking him about some of Ron Paul's ugly, ugly racist past. This is precious. Come on, Ron.
Congressman, as you are sort of breaking through some barriers in the polls, some other things are happening. There's been some talk again, resurfaced talk, about some things that you that were written in a newsletter under your name. I know you've started to address this, but in 2008, the New Republic, James Kirchick attributed some comments to you in newsletters where you referred to disturbances in Washington's Adams Morgan as animals taking over the D.C. Zoo, referring to African Americans. You said that Martin Luther King seduced underage girls and boys. You talked about Ronald Reagan proclaiming annual Hate Whitey Day with Martin Luther King Day, and you advocated prohibiting AIDS patients from eating in restaurants. These things were published under your name.
Yeah, but I didn't write them, and I disavowed them.
But you're a presidential candidate. That's tough, right? I mean, it kind of comes back to bite you that you made money off of things that were published under your name that were hateful and racist.
Yeah, but this has been addressed for 20 years, and nobody accuses me of that type of beliefs or language. I'm a true civil libertarian, and I think people dig these up when people think that, oh, his economic policies are winning, his foreign policies are winning, his monetary policies are winning, so they have to dig.
Monetary policies are winning. I mean, get me mature at all.
Yeah. His economic policies aren't winning. His economic policies are to grind an already ground damn near into the dirt populace, actually under said dirt.
Policies are winning.
These things up, which they really can't pin on me because they've been disavowed, and they're...
Ah, that the secretary will disavow all knowledge of your actions. I disavowed him.
But Ali Velshi's right. He put him out there. They were put out there under his name, and they were put out there and used as a means of hustling up dough from the folks who have a passion for bed linens as clothing.
They've been rehashed. Just go back and read all the articles, and there's all the explanations. So, yes, it wasn't good, but I didn't write them, and those aren't my beliefs, so I sleep well.
Are you comfortable in telling us who did write them? You haven't been able to sort of tell us specifically who wrote them.
I really don't know. 20 years ago, I had 6 or 8 people helping me with the letter, and I was practicing medicine, to tell you the truth.
Right.
And so I do not know.
But we could find out, because you had 6 or 8 people, like it's one of those 6 or 8 people?
Well, possibly I could, but...
I guess as you get closer to being president...
Yeah, but if we start asking about those 6 or 8 people, we might find out that one of the 6 or 8 people was me. And then it was actually me who wrote that stuff. And I took my rubber doctoring gloves off and started writing about how the dark-skinned people were just like animals, and the riots and Watts only stopped once the welfare checks came out. I was one of those 6 or 8 people. Maybe I just don't remember. That was 20 years ago, and, you know, I'm 76 years old now, and I don't remember so good anymore. And, I'm winning. I'm winning. That's what I'm doing.
Oh, Jesus. Somebody called Charlie Sheen.
United States folks want to know that you don't really dislike black people and people with AIDS and things like that. And I get what you're saying, that you're going up in the polls.
Why don't they concentrate on every word I've ever said, every speech I've ever given, every conference I've ever gone to,
right?
And maybe my beliefs are more important than, you know, stirring this up. So my beliefs, a true civil libertarian is a strong defense of individual liberties, and nobody's accused me of lacking a liberty.
Well, you know, like when your skin is dark and they won't let you eat at the lunch counter, as a strong defender of civil liberties, Ron Paul would say that
That person needs to exercise his economic power to walk away from that lunch counter and not give him his business, by crackies.
Or maybe it would be by crackers.
And that's that. Yeah, you'll show that Walgreens, won't you?
Except for when the white guy sits down where the dark-skinned guy was sitting, and they go on serving him, and...
Well, that just shows that there's not enough support for the market forces to change the market. And, you know, the unseen, unmoving hand that having writ moves on. And, you know, that's in the Bible.
Libertarian spirit of defending individuals. So these charges are total contradiction to everything I've said and everything I believe.
Do you think the media establishment's been fair to you or unfair?
Oh, you mean whether they're so biased? I don't know whether you use fair or unfair.
Okay, you think they're biased against you?
Well, I mean, why don't you go look at John Stewart's reports when he defends me on the biasness of the media? I mean, he mocked the media for the way they've treated me during the campaign and reported. But I don't get upset about that, and I don't. That's just the way you guys work, Si. It's no big deal to me. That's just the way. And the more progress I make in challenging the status quo, challenging the bankers, and challenging the bank bailouts, challenging this wicked foreign policy.
Challenging the bankers? Really? He's a free marketeer. Now, he would have been willing, I guess, to let some of those too-big-to-fail banks fail, and maybe that's a good thing. But he's not going to challenge any bankers. He worships the bankers.
Yeah, because, you know, they've got the money for the free market, and you know, once we go back onto the gold standard, and you know, once you can buy a gallon of gas with a silver dime, it'll be a different America, and a banker will be a banker again, and we'll have the free market out there, and it'll be every person for himself, and, you know, where, is it time for my insure yet?
Of war forever and the military-industrial complex, the stronger they will emphasize picking this and ignoring the important issues of what freedom is all about and what civil liberty is all about. And why don't you go look at a lot of comments about the war on drugs and how racist the enforcement of drug laws are. I mean, who else defends
the
racism and drug laws? Yeah, you know, you don't. You're constantly paying on something else. So somebody someday ought to look at the whole picture rather than picking out something I didn't write and I have disavowed. Yeah. So and that's been done many times. Go back and read the record.
It's the cost of surging in the polls, where people are paying a lot more attention to you, and they're going to start paying attention to all of these details. But you and I have talked many times. We've talked about a broad range of the things that you've written about. So I think we appreciate you coming on to have this discussion with us, and we continue to invite you to be on to have these discussions, the broad range of discussions of things that you care about. So we do appreciate that.
And stuff.
Congressman Ron Paul, Republican presidential candidate, and Congressman from Texas.
Boy, I tell you what, that's some million-dollar media right there, isn't it? I mean, that's some hard-hitting journalism. Apparently, the voter registration issue has garnered some interest. Michael, writing from Norway, he says, automatic voter registration, that's how it works here in Norway. As soon as someone is of voting age, they will automatically receive a card in the mail sometime before every election. On this card, they are informed when and where to go to deliver their vote, as well as how to go about early voting. So even if you don't follow any media and rarely are in touch with anyone, you will still know when it is time to vote and how to go about doing it. What's so awful about that? Well, the short answer is nothing is so awful about that. It actually makes sense unless your entire theory and philosophy of gaining and holding power relies upon people not voting. And that, of course, is the entirety of the Republican electoral scheme. It's about 2 minutes before the hour. We're going to take a quick break and come back. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. on your nickel, 304-658-3333. And we have one out of the five contributions to the Thrifty 250 that we need in order to match Robert's challenge, his Double Your Money $50 challenge for this evening. One out of five. We've got an hour to get the other four. This is the horn. Catching up with a little Christmas music this time through. I like this one a lot. Maybe it's my second favorite behind my new favorite, White Wine in the Sun. Greg Lake.
They said there'll be snow at Christmas. They said there'll be peace on earth. But instead it just kept on raining. A veil of tears for the virgin birth. I remember one Christmas morning, a winter's light and the distant choir, the peal of a bell and that Christmas tree smell, and eyes full of tinsel and fire. They sold me a sire knight. They told me a fairy story, till I believed in the Israelite. And I believed in Father Christmas. I looked to the sky with excited eyes. Then I woke with a yawn in the first light of dawn, and I saw him in his disguise.
Available yet to be had in this Wednesday night prayer meeting edition of the Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid, you know that, unless you're a new listener, in which case, you know, welcome. Avail yourself of the telephone line. This is something special here. An opportunity to engage in real dialogue, discussion, problem solving, consensus seeking. So many of the things that just aren't available via the for-profit media. When's the last time you got to talk back to Ari Velshi or Piers Morgan? Well, probably not Piers Morgan, because he's been busy answering questions in the phone hacking scandal in Great Britain. because the paper that he edited, The Mirror, it was said to be de rigueur to engage in phone hacking and various and sundry forms of illegal information gathering. Andy, writing in from California, noting the problem is not getting registered to vote, but whom to vote for. And he says, I noticed the biggest problem with voting is trying to figure out the track record of the slate of candidates you're given to vote for. It's fairly easy in California because many candidates are savvy enough to post League of Women Voters position statements and set up their own websites to explain their positions, philosophies, and news items of where they stand on various issues. In New Jersey, it was a different story. It was very difficult to find out anything about a slate of candidates. Unless you're consistently in tune with local newspapers, you're not going to have a good idea of what candidates stand for. Something I don't have that much time for. If it's not in the web when I'm ready to vote, I'm out of luck. Access to voting records is not easy to find, and the major factor you should consider is how a candidate voted on legislation in the past. DFA and PDA are helpful in trying to compare the positions and voting records of candidates. Without them, I would pretty much be lost. The benefits to showing up at DFA and PDA meetings, Democrats for America and Progressive Democrats of America, by the way, meetings, and learning about the candidates. Yeah, and those are real benefits, Andy, and I appreciate the absolute truth of everything that you've written. I think the problem on the front end, however, lies in the fact that we must be aware of the fact that of the two major political parties in the country, one of them benefits consistently by keeping people away from the polls. Consequently, every election year you see the raft of stories that come out of local Republican operations sending flyers to registered Democrats, for instance, or voters in targeted so-called urban ethnic areas, telling them that to vote the day that their time to go vote is the day after the election, and giving them the wrong precinct in the process. It's illegal as hell. It's dirty. It betrays the GOP for the filthy anti-democratic organization that it is. And it is what they do every chance they get. Now, figuring out who to vote for, Andy notes California. Well, it's in a way, it's equally easy to vote down in, say, Mississippi Stan or Alabama Stan. If you get past the table where you have to, in like Alabama Stan, where you have to show your, I don't know, your birth certificate, your baptism certificate, you're a good Christian voter. Then, of course, if your skin's nice and white and you haven't had to try to sign your name with a ballpoint pen on a piece of wax paper or anything like that, well, then they'll let you go vote, and by the time you get in there, you just know that you have to vote for the person with the best conservative family values. Because that is how, I guess the flood is a bit of a theme or a trope for tonight, that is how antediluvian politics are in large part in the Deep South. I'll never forget being down there during primary season with my dad in 2006, and the Democrats were, I'm a family values conservative, and that's what their ad said. And the Republicans said, I'm a family values conservative. Not a blessed word about whether or not they could do the job that they were seeking. Not a blessed word about what the issues really pressing upon the people of the area were. I got some family values. So everybody has to have family values down in the South, just like in order to run for, the Duma in the old Soviet Union. Was the Duma still, whatever the parliamentary body was, the Supreme Soviet or whatever, you had to be a member of the Communist Party. Well, it's the same way in the Deep South. You have to have conservative family values. And that, among other things, is why the House is not going to flip in 2012, which is why the House is able to play bad cop to the Senate Republicans playing good cop. It's all briar patch politics, pure and simple. Frustrating, isn't it? But moving over to a couple of other stories, you know, I spend a lot of time talking about coal extraction and the toxicity of it here in Appalachistan. And sometimes that may make it seem like I don't think it's going on anywhere else. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. I just got an email in from the somebody with who knows how to pronounce these Native American Alaskan names. Help me. Chuitna, Chuitna Citizens Coalition. They are battling. Now, it's not mountaintop removal up there. It's actually underneath the water structure, sort of the way that there's water table troubles and wetland problems associated with trying to uranium mine in Virginia. Oh, that's still just, what a great idea that is. But they are struggling to save the river of the same name in Alaska. And it's disturbing as hell. Because what the folks up there are trying to do, well, let me just share. The Cook Inlet Keeper and the Chuitna Citizens Coalition have partnered to petition the state of Alaska to make the salmon streams within the Chuitna watershed to designate them unsuitable for mining, which is a term of art, but it basically means you can't strip mine there. And there has been a massive campaign, and thousands of Alaskans have written their governor, whose name is Parnell, and they have written the Department of Natural Resources, pressing the demand that the salmon streams that have been essential and integral to the survival of those cultures for, 20,000 years or so, to protect them against the people who want to profit from the coal and send it to China. We literally are, you know, there's a handful of 1%ers who want to literally dig up our country and send it to some other country. Well, the governor of Alaska has responded. And he responds via a form letter. And if ever you wanted to hear a revolting piece of doublespeak, it comes from Sean Parnell, in the Alaska governor's office. Thank you for your email to Governor Sean Parnell expressing your concerns over the decision by Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan not to designate the Chuitna watershed as unsuitable for coal mining as requested by the trustees for Alaska. Please know that Governor Parnell's administration takes the sustainability of Alaska's salmon very seriously, except for the part about killing them and making them unsustainable, I added that. While a petition of this type is a legal and legitimate course of action, you little people, such a petition has never been granted before in Alaska because we are, our government, a wholly owned subsidiary of the extractive energy industry. Had the Chuitna watershed been designated by this petition alone as unsuitable for coal mining, any type of surface coal development project of any size by any entity in the area would have been prevented from seeking permits in the future. Instead, this project and everyone like it will go through the state's extensive and rigorous permitting process to evaluate each project's on the merits and then do exactly what the extractive industries want us to do. Commissioner Sullivan's decision is consistent with a similar decision made by former Commissioner Tom Irwin in 2007 and is also consistent with the extensive regulatory, legal, and judicial record for the Chuitna watershed. The assertion that reclamation in this area is technically feasible has been consistently upheld by Alaska's courts, who were bought out a long, long time ago. They're going to strip mine. I mean, you know, living around here, it's pretty amazing that they blow up entire mountains and bury streams. Well, in Alaska, they want to strip mine the river itself and replace it with a concrete gutter that they then say will serve as a valid reclamation of the spawning grounds of the salmon. Hey, I just swam all this way to go up and spawn, and there's nothing here but a ditch. Oh, that's your spawning ground. The hell it is! I'm a salmon, I should know! The decision not to designate lands as unsuitable for coal mining does not mean that a mine will automatically be permitted in the Chittenah watershed. No, what means it'll automatically be permitted is the vast amounts of money that we're given by the extractive industries in this state. It simply allows the project to undergo evaluation through the state's permitting process, which is very, very lax and considers a wide variety of environmental concerns, like many of which are expressed in the petition, and also allows numerous opportunities for public comment and input of corporate cash into our coffers. The law and permitting processes must be allowed to function as intended to ensure a consistent regulatory policy that protects our environment while providing for responsible development of our bank accounts, our natural resources. I didn't get a harumph over there. Now, this is a letter from Sean Parnell, Governor Sean Parnell, and I guess he likes to refer to himself in the third person. Governor Parnell understands the importance of sustainable fisheries to all Alaskans. Governor Parnell will ensure that if and when development permit applications are received for mining in the Chittenah watershed, they're subjected to Alaska's rigorous permitting process that, as stated above, will provide multiple opportunities for public review and comments before we permit them after we've been paid off handsomely. Sincerely, yada, yada, yada. Oh, actually, it was written by Rachel Bilsma. God, Bilsma. Sounds like something you go to the doctor to get a shot for. Sounds like a bubble in a bathtub. There is not one corner of this sad and tired planet where somebody who hasn't yet figured out that they don't put U-Hauls behind hearses doesn't want to destroy something to get a little richer. There is no corner of this sad little planet where any of us can feel safe. That's why when I get the emails, and they're very concerned and loving and kind emails, that's why when I get the emails from you saying, you know, Bob, why don't you and Agnes and the kids pick up and move? Well, even if we had the funds with which to do it, which we don't, but even if we did, I don't think I could. Because wherever I went, somebody would want to build a nuclear plant, or somebody else would want to put up a new high-tech, clean, green, coal-fired power plant, or maybe they'd want to drill for oil or frack for gas, or somehow or another poison our ability to exist. I'm sensitive to what's going on in Appalachia because it's going on under my nose and before my eyes. But don't think for a minute that that doesn't make, that I don't also understand that everyone else is under attack as well. There is no place on, in this country where you have the right for which, you know, the fought and died and bled and sacrificed and all of that that we honor on Memorial Day and Veterans Day and the 4th of July. There's nowhere in this country that someone chasing unholy profit is not willing to absolutely destroy the lives of everyone who lives anywhere near the object of their avarice and lust. Nowhere. Nowhere. The stories are legion. Love Canal. The little town in Massachusetts. Montana, and Montana again, and Montana some more, the Powder River Basin of Wyoming. The Powder River's just toxic. Along the banks of the Missouri and the Mississippi, where when the river freezes in winter, they try to melt the ice so the coal barges can get through, and they melt the ice by dumping coal fly ash that has concentrations of barium and cadmium and mercury and selenium and arsenic and aluminum and magnesium and manganese and every heavy metal on the damned periodic table in concentrations far beyond the human comprehension almost. They dump that to melt the ice, and they put that into the river, and then sit back and go, well, goddamn, wonder why we got some mercury in the river. Wonder why the fish ain't safe to eat, huh? I know that. But there's something in my soul that tells me that the fight can be won here in Appalachia. Just like the first battle of the Revolution was fought here in what is now West Virginia. Just like the first land battle of the Civil War that led to the elimination of slavery was fought here in West Virginia. Just like the miners marched on Blair Mountain in a demand to be treated as human beings, and it happened in West Virginia. It's just in my guts that if we are going to beat these rapacious bastards, we will beat them here, and we will cut them off at the knees and then kick their asses for being short. We can do it here. But that doesn't mean that I've got some Pollyanna view of it being easy. God, the ignorance is stunning. Was it a town hall or? It was on Fox News. There's a Republican member of Congress named Ed Whitfield, and he is, of course, from Kentucky Stan. And he is deeply in the pocket of the coal industry and had himself a plum conniption today because the poor old bedraggled, embattled Environmental Protection Agency actually stood up and did something for little human beings. The EPA has finalized its mercury rule. Not arsenic, not cadmium, not barium, not lead, not mercury. Yes, mercury. Not selenium, not manganese, not aluminum. But they finalized a mercury rule today. Recently. It limits emissions of mercury, arsenic, and other toxins, oh look, from the country's electric power plants, and may actually mean that two of the poisoning little death factories have to close. It took 20 years to get this rule through. It was 1990 when the amendments to the Clean Air Act compelled the EPA to set standards for the emission of mercury, arsenic, and other toxic air pollution from coal-fired power plants. The court decree said that it had to happen by 2000. The dim leader administration spent 8 years making sure that they damned well didn't happen. But finally they have. And that means thousands and thousands of babies will not be poisoned in the womb and ever after. That their little developing brains won't be enfeebled by mercury. That 17,000 premature deaths won't happen. That hundreds of thousands of illnesses won't happen. Now, they're not, if I understand correctly, they're not carved in stone yet. And, of course, there is a right-wing hissy afoot. I mentioned Republican Ed Whitfield of Kentucky Stan. Who, despite the science, and there is science behind what I just mentioned to you about the health benefits of not pumping mercury into babies' bodies, despite that science, and despite the fact that Ed Whitfield is pro-life, because he's got some family values, despite all that, he actually had the gall to say, well, never, why read it when you can hear it, right? Yeah. Tell us about it, Ed.
New regulations, they say, to limit mercury, basically from spewing into the environment. Now, that sounds like a good thing. Why are you opposed to it?
Well, first of all, that's not actually the case. There are already strict regulations relating to mercury emissions. All of the hearings that we held on this utility regulation indicated that overwhelmingly the benefits would come from reduced particulate matter, not mercury at all.
Obviously, jobs versus health or versus the environment, because as I'm sure you know, for the past several years, doctors have been advising pregnant women not to eat any fish when they're pregnant because the mercury levels are so high in fish. So what to do about this? Obviously, whatever controls the EPA has in place are not working if our fish are tainted.
Well, let me just say this to you. The scientists that testified before our committee, unanimous in the view that there's not going to be any benefit from this regulation in reducing mercury levels. All of the benefits were calculated from the reduction of particulate matter, which is already covered under ambient air quality standard regulations. This is about closing coal plants, and that's precisely what it's about.
Yeah, them babies. Screw them babies. Ain't nothing good. You know what? When our youngins were little, we'd pour them a bowl of cream of wheat, and we'd put a little extra mercury in there because mercury don't hurt a baby. He sounds like an idiot, doesn't he? That's what I was saying earlier about science. It doesn't matter what he believes. Science doesn't wait for him to believe in it before it becomes viable. It's not like a religious movement. It just is. And if you don't want to believe the science, so to speak, then that's okay. Science and evolution will happily pass you by and let you learn about it the hard way. But the problem is that the Ed Whitfields of the world would gladly externalize that learning curve onto those of us who do understand how evil, how pernicious, how wicked, how toxic it is to pump that kind of filth into the air and to do it just to make a profit. There shines the sun, the source of all our power. And again, it's a matter of science. The science is there that we can transition right now to wind and solar. And nobody's bulbs will even dim. Well, maybe some bulbs will dim, or maybe some bulbs are just dim to begin with. Because you know what happened with the proposed legislation, right? Yeah, this just... Had it gone through... You gotta love this. This is breathtaking. Let me just read the text of it. The late-night conference agreement on an omnibus funding bill for the federal government for the rest of fiscal 2012... Oh, wait a minute. Includes a provision proposed by the House prohibiting funds to implement or enforce higher efficiency light bulb standards. The teabag light bulb ban rider is opposed by lighting manufacturers. Dozens of lighting manufacturers issued a press release. Also, efficiency groups and so-called environmentalists, I'm a human rights advocate, issued a letter this week to senators, and they said, or last week, and they said, eliminating funding for light bulb efficiency standards is especially poor policy, as it would leave the policy in place but makes it impossible to enforce, undercutting domestic manu... Whoa, wait a minute, what? undercutting domestic manufacturers who have invested millions of dollars in U.S. plants to make new incandescent bulbs that meet the standards. Well, I will be dipped. We do still make something in the United States. We make light bulbs. And, of course, the Repiglicans wanted to kill that fledgling industry. It's not really fledgling anymore. It's in its adolescence, but it's not full grown. They wanted to kill it. Why? Well, the teabaggers said, because I want the freedom to have my patriotic free market incandescent light bulbs in my lighting sockets. Because that's the kind of light that Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Constitution under. And that's the kind of light I want to pledge allegiance to the flag under. And that's what they float out there for their mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking comrades. But the reality of it is that of all, you know, the right wing, they hate them some windmills. God knows they hate them some solar panels. But more than anything else, they hate the single most effective means of cutting energy usage, and that is simple conservation. Oh, they hate them some conservation. They despise conservation. And they want those inefficient, rotten old, change it every couple of months, incandescent light bulbs in the sockets, because that means there's more electricity being drawn, and that in turn means there's more load on the power plants, and that in turn means that there's more coal being fed into the filthy maw of those power plants, and that means more profits for the poisoners. But of course they wrap it up in a flag and hook a Bible to it, and you know, the baby Jesus was born under an incandescent lamp, and I got family values, and I want to live under the same light my Lord and Savior lived under. Hallelujah. There is actually an American light bulb manufacturing industry, and goddamn if the Republicans don't want to kill it. I mean, that story out of New Paris, Ohio, was another one for the list. Remember when Highland Park, Michigan, turned out its street lights? Remember when the lights went out in Highland Park, Michigan? Oh, Rick, it seems the lights are going out all over the world. Remember that line from Casablanca? Well, they're not going out all over the world, but they're damn sure going out all over America. If you recall Monday's program, we discussed poor folks in the west end of Birmingham, Alabama. 85-year-old grannies and the like who have to walk out across frozen pavement to go and relieve themselves in a port-a-john, you know, a 21st century outhouse. Whether it's blazing hot or freezing cold. Because the modern conveniences of plumbing are now past our civilizational capabilities. And so, too, the lights have gone out in New Paris, Ohio. Hello, irony alert. Remember Paris, the city of lights? Well, New Paris, Ohio is the city of darks. Officials say the village of New Paris, Ohio's funding from the state has been slashed by 25%, and another 25% will be cut next year. Austerity, anyone? So to try to make ends meet, the village is preparing to end its contract with Dayton Power and Light at the end of the month. That would save more than $17,000, but leaders fear it could also cost villagers in safety. Fear my rear end, it will cost in safety. You know, the dark has been the bane of humankind since the earliest days when we came, before we came down out of the trees. There are things in the dark, and they're not supernatural, and they're not from another realm. They're very much of this earth. There are cats and wolves. And other animals with sublime night vision. And we humans, we're practically blind in the dark. And we go from being predator to prey very easily as the night falls. So it was with our earliest hominid relatives, and so it is today. Because we don't just prey upon other species. There are elements within our own who prey upon each other. And when the lights go out, in ever so many ways, civilization goes with it. These are, of course, as a result, these hard decisions are, of course, the result of having Republican governors in office. Because Republican governors have to sign off on the idea that countries and states and municipalities and counties are somehow going to survive without anyone paying taxes for upkeep. And it's not even a slippery slope. It's a damn slicky slide into the abyss. John Kasich in Ohio has there's no downflow of money because we can't pay no taxes. Taxes is un-American. There will be no jobs created out of the darkness of New Paris, Ohio. There will be no jobs created out of the darkness of Highland Park, Michigan. There will be no jobs created in the ruins of homes let burn by for-profit fire companies. There will be no jobs created in formerly paved roads that have been reground to gravel. Oh, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there will be jobs created in private security militia that wander the streets to deal with the predators. And private fire companies that spring up to, maybe it's the competitive marketplace. Well, you know, our fire rates are cheaper than their fire rates. Of course, we don't have any trucks or any water or anything, but, you know, we'll stand around and watch your house burn down and make sure. Well, you get the idea. What a nation! This is where we stand, and it's a hell of a little list we've gotten on our hands. And understand, of course, that it's not just America. Damn tragic story. I didn't find it. News Ninja Gene found it. He reads the internet every day. A new study from the Greek health ministry. This is what you get when you let the money people enforce austerity on the people who actually make the country run. The rate of increase in suicides in Greece was the highest in Europe in the first half of 2011, according to figures from the Greek health ministry. Experts attribute the rise to the country's economic crisis. Painful austerity measures and a seemingly endless economic drama are exacting a deadly toll on the nation. Statistics released by the Greek Ministry of Health show a 40% rise in those taking their own lives. 40%! In those taking their own lives between January and May of this year compared to the same period in 2010. And here's the real sick part. Before austerity was rammed down up the body politic of the people of Greece, it had the lowest suicide rate in Europe. 2.8 per 100,000. It now has almost 5.6 per 100,000. Around 5.3. And it's deadly serious business because they take their religion seriously over there. And you know what? If you off yourself, the Orthodox priest will not allow you to have magic funeral rites. And the global 1% have the blood of those suicides on their hands. And the question is, would they be allowed funeral rites? Well, you know, if they die in the Lord. Unemployment is 18%. Of that 18%, 42% affects the 25 to 40 age group in Greece. Crime has gone through the roof. In central Athens alone, the number of homeless exceed 20,000 souls. But you know what? As long as the bank boys get their money, it doesn't matter how much blood spills over the cobblestones. Because profit is fueled by the blood of the innocents. I don't like it, but it is a fact. And we're not in the believing business here. We're in the fact business. And the fact is, the profit mongers do not care whom they kill as long as they get their profits. I had an email from our buddy Bill last night that said, and a happy inventory liquidation season to you as well. That's why I love that Greg Lake song so much. Because it speaks to taking something sweet and decent and transforming it into something filthy and tawdry and painted up in the cheap cosmetics of lucre. You know what I mean? So it's here, it's in Greece, it's all over us. And of course the Republicans are still squealing for the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. Over at Huffington Post today, Michael Broun, who is the executive director of the Sierra Club, has an excellent article called The Keystone XL Pipeline Scam. And he says, bless his heart bluntly, because we need some blunt. We don't need a blunt. Now, you guys stop that. The politicians pushing the pipeline are, how can I put this politely, lying to the American people and pandering for dirty oil money. What do we really stand to gain if this thing is rammed down our throats? Higher gas prices, more air pollution, the threat of poisoned water, and enough carbon pollution to make stopping climate disruption next to impossible, but few of the jobs and none of the huge profits that big oil would reap. And that is true. And yet you will find, especially in among the right wing, people hooting and hollering wanting this thing built. Well, it'll bring jobs. Well, damn, it'll bring a job that's 2 years long. Then what do you do with the jobless guy or woman? A couple of big labor organizations are just absolutely over the moon for this thing. What does it take to get them to see past the ends of their own noses? That there's so much more to be had in a green and sustainable economy than any pipeline can ever produce. I mean, you know that something really stinks when a retired brigadier general, a person by the name, a fellow by the name of Stephen Anderson, said, I mean, this is a military type. The Keystone XL pipeline will not reduce America's dependence on Middle East oil or do anything to get us off oil completely, which is key to America's national security future. Much of the oil produced by Keystone won't go right to American gas tanks. It is to be exported, meaning we will need to import oil the same as before. And you know, just full stop. Because that's not some long-haired, granola-eating, tie-dyed t-shirt-wearing hippie freak. Me, I like long-haired, tie-dyed, t-shirt-wearing, granola-eating hippie freaks. But there's a lot of people out there that think that if you got yourself a damn buzz cut and you wear a little green suit, that that somehow gives you a more relevant opinion. Well, right-wingers, listen to General Stephen Anderson. It won't go to America's gas tanks. It is to be exported, meaning that we will need to import oil the same as before. Will the filthy profit mongers bought off in the Senate and the House listen to a general? No, probably not, because he's not saying what they want to hear. Michael Brune notes that the costs of the extended costs of the pipeline will be externalized onto the American people. And I'm not trying to be mean to Canadians. I like Canadians. I wish you would hurry up and annex the Turks and Caicos Islands so I can become a Canadian and live in the Caribbean. This is not hateful, but honestly, why can't, I mean, if the pipeline is so important to, what is it, Trans-Canada? Or what's the name of them? What's the Trans-Canada. Because Michael Brune notes they have a dismal record of cutting corners, ignoring the law, and spilling oil. Keystone 1 spilled more than 12 times in its first year of operation, including a 21,000-gallon spill in North Dakota. That one shot a 60-foot geyser of oil into the air. The EPA determined that sections of Keystone 1 were constructed using inferior steel and defective welds. Well, we all know where that came from. We remember you. We remember you, Kenny. I'll never forget the pictures. You know, he was a master welder and an inspector, and he sent photos of Chinese steel piping, and they had these vast, they were steam lines. But in light of the fact that this goo coming down the Keystone XL pipeline will have to be heated at all phases of the process, you get the same sort of, yeah, cheap, inferior steel. 60-foot geyser. Lovely, isn't it? And all the profits will go to the corporations, and all of the costs will be externalized onto you and me and all of us. And yet, if you recall that story that I had just a couple of weeks ago, I can't get it out of my mind. And yet, if you just consider coal leaving the western United States and leaving Illinois and central Appalachia completely out of the mix, if you just consider western coal going to Asia, it is by orders of magnitude more dangerous, more poisonous, more of a climate disaster than the Keystone XL pipeline. And the profit monkeys want them both. Maybe this is a good time to remind us, they want it all. They want it all. And that's what makes it frustrating, you know, to read stories, pieces by Michael Brune like this. And by the way, he notes that at least one oil company backing the pipeline, Valero, has made it clear that its main goal is to reach growing foreign diesel fuel markets. Port Arthur, Texas, where the Keystone XL would end, is a foreign trade zone. That means oil companies would avoid paying U.S. taxes on oil that is imported from Canada, refined in Texas, and then exported to China, Latin America, or Europe. Michael Brune says the American people get to assume all of the risk, but would see none of the benefits, not even the tax revenues. But not having any tax revenues, they'd be job creators then, wouldn't they? And so recognizing that, and knowing all that we know about what's being done to this country, and the crazy crap going on all over the world, and a House of Representatives that doesn't have time to consider whether legislation is good or bad, but does have time to commission taxpayer dollars to place a statue of Winston Churchill in the Capitol. No, really. And Steve King of Iowa, the guy who said life would be so much better if all those gay people would just stop acting so gay, sat in a hearing about the Stop Online Piracy Act that would put most of the internet out of business, and claimed that he was bored, and said that Sheila Jackson has so bored me. This is a quote. Sheila Jackson has so bored me that I'm killing time by surfing the internet. Ms. Jackson Lee took him to task for that, and was compelled later to change her language so as not to be censured by the House for saying something unkind about Steve King. Really, I guess it's the uppity black lady rule of conduct and decorum of a Republican-led House of Representatives. Knowing all of that, all of these things, I have to admit that I took a little pleasure in a science story out of the New York Times. It is in this season that we talk about, or that holy book talks about, a star appearing in the east. Well, they didn't have high-powered optics back then, but we have them now. There's a lot of data flowing back to Earth from the Kepler spacecraft. And some of that data resulted in an announcement this yesterday that two Earth-sized planets have been found orbiting a distant star. One of them is about as big as Earth. The other is slightly smaller than Venus. They're not that far out. I strongly suggest, whether it's true or not, that we put out a press release that says that the planet, by virtue of its mass spectrometry signature, has been determined to be absolutely filthy rich in coal, oil, and natural gas, and ready for inhabitation. Because that'll solve a lot of our problems. Research and development efforts will immediately be undertaken to allow us to colonize those two planets. We can name one Exxon and the other Mobil. And free market, libertarian, Tea Party, and God-fearing, upstanding, you know the drill, can all get on the spaceship and fly away to the planets of unlimited oil, coal, and gas. But here's the secret. We don't tell them until the ships are past their point of no return that the surface temperature of the planets is 1400 degrees Fahrenheit. See how it works? Tell me that's not genius. Tell me you wouldn't sign on to that that effort. Not that you'd sign on to the ship, but tell me you wouldn't sign on to the effort almost immediately. I mean, my God, as Jug-a-Punch says in the chat room, you can almost see Don Blankenship packing his bags already. And that creep from BP who wanted his life back. Let's give it back to him on a planet whose temperature is 1400 degrees Fahrenheit. We'll save the Goldilocks planet for the normal people. So it's time to roll on out of here. Thank you for the one matching contribution for Robert's challenge. Hopefully a little more will roll in by the end of the evening, and I can let Robert know that it's been matched. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. Thanks to our chat room moderators, Lottie and Sparky. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. To our blogger, Texas Betsy. Happy Hanukkah, by the way. To our op-ed columnist, Reverbo, Cavalcade of Crazy Head on RadioNetwork.com. He's having a rumpus in Hangar 5, by the way. That's just a joke. My head writer, David, in Tennessee, had the night off. Hope you enjoyed it, David. He told me earlier today, Pa Kettle is going to town. Thanks to John Fox, our chief engineer, webmaster, web designer, producer, maintainer of Bob's technical sanity. Hope you're having a beautiful holiday season there, John, you and Gail. And a happy holiday season to you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org, who has, for over 9 years now, almost 10, single-handedly saved progressive liberal radio by making it available on the internet and never sending a bill in the process. There are unsung heroes in this world, and Ben Birch is one of them. A gentle reminder to run by CRMW.net, Coal River Mountain Watch. They are the hardest working, bravest people I know. And it is through the work of Coal River Mountain Watch and other allies that we will bring an end to an apocalypse. When you go to the website, you know, you can sign up for the email newsletter. I strongly urge you to do so. You can also buy one of the coolest T-shirts available on the internet, wherever with mine on. People, I want one of those. It just says, Save the Endangered Hillbilly. And they're cheap, too. And if you're of a mind to do it, you can even contribute, which would be lovely. I can't think of a better place to do that. It is an honor and a privilege to work with them. Truly. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next, only on the Horn.
KRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Guess it's going to be one of those weeks. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network, America's liberal voice, the home of the incredibly unique conversation radio that is unlike just about anything happening in broadcast anywhere at any time. It's going to be one of those weeks where every time we press the buttons, we just kind of have to stick our tongues out this right and hold one arm up in the air and stand on our toes and just hope that everything connects. For a while there, it looked like nothing was going to connect, but, well, it did. And I'm here, and you're there, and I'm grateful for all of it. I'm very thankful for both ends of that whole process. It's about 3 minutes past the hour. It is Thursday, the 22nd day of December. We are headed downhill toward Christmas. And just a reminder of the Christmas schedule, we will have a show tomorrow night. It'll include an annual tradition of the reading from the Gospels, as perpetrated by Agnes and my three now teenage children, Margie, Berg, and Doodle. And then, of course, Saturday's Christmas Eve, Sunday's Christmas, Monday, in many parts of the Christmas-celebrating world, is something that people call Boxing Day. I guess it's when you clean up your mess after Christmas and maybe have a few snorts along the way and sing a little bit or something. I think it's a terribly, terribly civilized little habit, and I think it would be well to adopt it here, but we haven't. But here, it's also something else, and something more significant, for at least for this little tribe of ours. And we have a birthday on the 26th, namely Ferg's birthday. I guess guys don't have sweet 16s. Maybe guys have super 16s or superior 16s or stupendous 16s or what have you. But whatever it is, we're having one on Monday. So don't count on a show Monday, because we try to take the kids out to do something with them on their birthday. And that'll be Ferg's out doing something on his birthday night. But the 27th, the 28th, the 29th, the 30th, yeah, those are all right. Yeah, Calf, manly 16s, but you know, we're looking for that whole alliterative thing. And I don't know, maybe in the course of the program we can come up with a right and proper answer. So here, there we go. So that's the schedule. Tonight and tomorrow, programming. Then next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, programming. All of which is, of course, conditioned upon and dependent upon and reliant upon the condition precedent that the interweb tubes actually work. But I guess every broadcast is that way, isn't it? This is The Horn. We are conversation radio. We are listener-supported. And, in fact, we still have an extant challenge from Robert, otherwise known as Phase 5, down in Australia. We got one out of the five contributions, $10 contributions we needed last night. We need four more. And on top of that, frankly, it would be great if we could get six or seven or eight or nine just to try to sort of keep up. You know, it takes between six and ten thrifty 250 contributions per show to keep things on an even keel. So the PayPal button is over at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. Also there you will find the snail mail address of 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB. I forget what the... Is that something... Paul Mary Bravo, 318... 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, West Virginia, 25801. And a gentle reminder from Boss Man Wayne, if you prefer to send a check, please don't make the check payable to Bob Kincaid, because they look at him funny when he goes to do our banking. Make it payable to the Horn or Hit on Communications or something like that. Okay, great. Where to begin? I guess we've all heard the news by now that apparently Boehner blinked, which in itself is simply a visual image. The little one-eyed fellow just errant, like, kind of like Popeye. No, John Boehner blinked, and I guess a deal is going to go through, and the House is going to vote up or down, as the Repiglickens like to say, on whether to let millions of unemployed people continue to at least meet their basic needs until they can find work in an economy that one hopes might be recovering, but the data for which is yet sort of, less than clear. Right? And that it's terribly interesting. I didn't know you could shame a Repiglickan, but apparently they have been. I guess maybe the natives are restless even in places that have conservative family values, like Alabama-stan and Mississippi-stan and Georgia-stan and the very beating red bloody hearts of teabaggery. But at least that was the news that was being reported a short time ago, that there will be a vote, a House vote, on this piece of legislation. We shall see. Now, in other, I've got a story that's kind of a leftover from last night, but it's a story that needs mentioning, needs to be put out there. It's the story of Kevin William Harpum. Do you remember Martin Luther King Jr. Day, 2011, January 17th, 2011? When they were getting ready to parade in celebration of Dr. King's birth in Spokane, Washington. And it turns out a backpack bomb was found that could have maimed, crippled, and killed God knows how many participants in the parade. You know, Martin Luther King Day. What Ron Paul, in his newsletter some years ago, referred to as Ronald Reagan knuckling under and signing into law Hate Whitey Day. That's how Ron Paul, libertarian, that's how Ron Paul thinks of Martin Luther King Day. It's Hate Whitey Day. You know, Ron Paul, libertarian gynecologist. I mean, just a question for the ladies in the audience, the women folk. Really? And you know, there's a couple of Repiglickan conservative, white, pasty-faced, doughy gynecologists in their caucus. There's Tom Coburn from Oklahoma. And I do believe, yet because they talk all the time, you know, Dr. Paul has delivered millions of babies. And this is just a general survey question for Thorn in the Side Thursday. And it's for the women folk. Would you let a right-wing Repiglickan conservative anywhere near you if you were in a set of stirrups? I'm not trying to conjure up any images or anything, but honestly, would you? I mean, God, that's like, I don't know, that's like it's like letting an eagle be a proctologist, you know, with the claw. Just bend over, sir. No! No! But, how did I get off on Ron Paul? I know how. He has said, You know, I played you that clip last night of him talking to Ari Velshi and creepy old Emperor Palpatine Darth Sidious Ron Paul getting bent out of shape when Ari Velshi dared to question him about his, you know, newsletters. The ones that referred to things like Hate Whitey Day. And I guess the, I guess it's just getting a little bit uglier for Dr. Paul. Dr. Sidious. Because, among other things, CNN's Gloria Borger asked him about it. And he... How can you tell? I mean, Ron Paul's just a... Hey, he's a cranky old freak. So it's kind of hard to tell when he's not being cranky. But, yeah, he got kind of cranky about it with Gloria Borger. This won't take long. Assuming it starts. Someday. Oh, dear. Maybe I should have rebooted the computer. Well, you'll have that.
There are reports that you made almost $1 million.
Really? $1 million? Doing what, Gloria Borger? Well, we'll find out presently. Yeah, here we go.
There are reports that you made almost $1 million off of them in 1993.
Oh, I'd like to see that money.
In nice, thin silver dimes, I'd like to see that. You know, you can buy a gallon of gas with a silver dime.
Of course he made money off of those hate-filled, racist, bigoted, prejudiced newsletters. That's why they went out, because every one of them had a, can you please give to help keep the Congress white with Dr. Ron Paul?
Yeah.
But he doesn't like being accused of making money off of his former racism. Or, what is, well, it's, come on, it's his present racism. It's just kind of closeted. Yeah, closets aren't just for gay folks. They're for racists, too. And apparently, Ron Paul is trying to desperately get back into his.
So, you read them, but you didn't do anything about it at the time.
I never read that stuff. I never read it. I was probably aware of it 10 years after it was written. And it's been going on 20 years that people have pestered me about this. And
yeah, because, see, that's what it is. It's pestering, Dr. Paul. You put out newsletters that were filled with just racist filth. And now you claim you never read it? So, in other words, somebody could have been writing these things for you and saying that Dr. Ron Paul believes that there's a race of men in the trees, And Dr. Ron Paul believes that we are about to be imminently invaded by aliens from the planet Norblap Zimblod. Head for the hills. And he just wouldn't have known it as long as the checks were clearing, right?
And did the checks clear? Oh, good. Send in my next patient. I hope it's not one of them dark ones. And you've been pestering me about this. I never read that sort of... What kind of a president would he be... who doesn't read his own materials going out to his alleged constituents? I'm just asking.
CNN does it every single time. So well, when are you going to wear yourself out?
I mean,
out?
When you say it's... No, but,
when
you
know,
is it legitimate? I mean, is it a legitimate question to ask that something went out under
you
your name?
When you get the answer, it's legitimate that you sort of take the answers. I guess, you know what? The answer is, I didn't write them. I didn't read them at the time, and I disavow them.
I wasn't there, I didn't do it, and even if I did do it, I was only following orders.
That's the answer.
Well, it's just a question. I mean, it's legitimate.
Well, keep telling him it's legitimate. He's going to keep telling you, Gloria, that it went out under his name, but he never read it. Come on. At least George Wallace had the what? Honesty to own up to his racism, and he later on was said to have had a sea change in his thinking. But not Dr. Paul. No, he's gonna take this all the way to the newsletters that were mine and under my name and everything, and I was paying somebody to write them, but I never read them. One of these days I gotta sit down and read them. I can't. Oh, wonder where.
There's a lot of things that I need to read. I plan to finally get through Moby Dick. You know, that's a tough read, that Moby Dick. You know, all those free market whalers out there being attacked by those god-awful whales in the sea. I've got to read that. I'll read that. I'll sit down and, you know what, I'll read these memos where I was saying all these nasty racist things that I never read before. I'll read them after I finish Moby Dick, and maybe Bleak House and Nicholas Nickleby and the Epic of Gilgamesh. And, you know, I've been a very busy doctor, and there's a lot of things I'd like to read, but...
It's legitimate. These things are pretty incendiary. You know,
because of people like you.
No. Come on. Some of the stuff was very incendiary. And, you know, saying that in 1993 the Israelis were responsible for the bombing of the World Trade Center, that kind of stuff. So,
goodbye.
All right.
Yeah, goodbye. Right. Goodbye. I'm taking the microphone.
Appreciate your answering the questions. And you understand it's our job to ask them.
Thank you.
No, he doesn't understand. He's a nasty old reconstructed racist, and he doesn't like being confronted about it because he doesn't have the courage of his convictions. He's a cut purse racist. He's a sneak thief racist. He's a shiv between the ribs racist. He's not a straight up Lester Maddox, George Wallace, in your face racist. No, he's the worst kind, because he'll let you think that, oh yeah, I'm a dedicated civil libertarian. And then, well, you just got to wonder what kind of raisin young Rand Paul got. But no matter what, he says he is damn sure not going to tell anybody who those people were who wrote that newsletter. Jim asking Ron Paul, was he in Bruno? Maybe not Bruno, but maybe he was in, what was Sacha Baron Cohen's previous one? Yeah, and Jim's point being, was he in Bruno? What an idiot for being set up. And it is kind of reminiscent of an episode of Sacha Baron Cohen's, isn't it? But it's only a setup if you have no reason to see it coming. And instead of dealing with this stuff on its face and up front, Ron Paul keeps trying to pretend it didn't happen. And that he didn't it was his newsletter. It just was. And he could very easily say, well, here's the guy who wrote it. But the problem is, even if he identifies someone else as having written it, then he's going to have to explain how long he remained on his payroll after he wrote it, or why he wasn't fired, or maybe the fact that he just stayed on the payroll even though he penned this filth. But that's just who Ron Paul is. Remember, his son, Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, learned at his knee. And it was the learning that he got from his daddy that caused him to tell Rachel Maddow that, no, you know, the Civil Rights Act should never have been passed, that the free market should take care of that kind of thing. But I guess I'm sort of running afield on this, because I was actually starting out talking about Kevin William Harpum, who actually pleaded guilty for planning to detonate a bomb during the 2011 Martin Luther King Jr. Day March in Spokane, Washington. He was due to be sentenced on December the 20th, and he was sentenced. And this is one of those that you can file in the win column, because the federal judge who sentenced him sent him up the river for hard federal time for 32 years. Kevin Harpum is now trying to appeal because he thinks his sentence was too rough. He also said, and this is the important part of the story, in offering his statement to the judge of why he filled a backpack with explosives and set it to go off next to the Martin Luther King Jr. Day parade in Spokane, Washington, he said, I was making, pay attention to this, this is so important, I was making a statement that there are people out there who don't agree with these ideas. Which ideas? Well, the ideas for which Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. lived and died. You know, those wild-eyed radical liberal ideals, like the idea that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That one ought not be barred from participating in one's polis simply by virtue of the color of one's skin, that people ought to be judged by the content of their character and not by the color of their skin. These are the things that Kevin Harpham disagrees with and wanted to send a message of his disagreement. He said, because you got to understand, his bomb was full of shrapnel. And he said it was just supposed to explode against a wall and not hurt anybody. Now that is curious, because all of the shrapnel in his pipe bombs, in his backpack bomb, all of the shrapnel had been dipped in rat poison. So that even the most tangential contact with it could cause horrible problems, bleeding problems. You know, rat poison is roughly the same thing as the prescription medication used as a blood thinner called Coumadin. It's called warfarin, is the chemical name. Kevin Harpham was honorably discharged from the Army. He had no criminal record. And Federal Judge Quackenbush, really, Justin Quackenbush said, I am distressed that you appear not the least bit apologetic. And in so doing, handed down a sentence of 32 years. And it'll be hard for Mr. Harpham to get out, hell, even in 16. And this is what needs to happen with racists. Once they've taken some overt step. Judge Justin Quackenbush went on to say that Mr. Harpham was influenced by, and this is a quote, this is a write-it-downer, he was influenced by a shrill and caustic and vitriolic culture fueled by talk media. He means talk radio. He means Fox, Radio Rwanda. Because, see, I don't care who that person is. There is nobody on the liberal left or progressive spectrum, whatever, that urges violence, that urges anyone be hurt or killed. And there's certainly no one on the liberal left who thinks that Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday holiday should be referred to as Hate Whitey Day. I've listened to a number of liberal and left and progressive talkers. I've known some and call them friends. I've never heard Rick Smith urge violence. I know I myself have never urged violence. Mike Malloy hasn't. Guy James never did. No one on the horn did. I've never heard Stephanie Miller to, you know, she's funny. That's just beyond her. I've never heard Stephanie Miller do it. Even Big Eddie Schultz, I've never heard suggest that anyone should be harmed for simply having a different skin color. Tom Hartman certainly never has. Peter Werby, no. None of them, past or present. Oh, but Lordy, just tune in and spend a couple of hours with Sean Hannity, or Flush Flemball, or O'Reilly, or God knows the Beckerhead. Remember, this is Washington. This is where the Beckerhead grew up. And it was Glenn Beck who exhorted his listeners to take to the streets and kill people who worked for the Tides Foundation. This is Glenn Beck who told his viewers and listeners that he would like to personally murder Michael Moore. You know, there were books by Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity in the possession of a man named Adkins. Not to mention, Bernie Goldberg's 100 People Who Are Ruining America hit list. Mr. Adkins, having been fed a steady diet of right-wing hate, took a shotgun into the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist congregation in Knoxville, Tennessee, and started blowing people away during a children's play. Annie, as a matter of fact. And this is, of course, what I submit to you, Federal Judge Justin Quackenbush was referring to when he said that Mr. Harpham had been influenced by a shrill and caustic and vitriolic culture fueled by talk media. He added, that is contrary to what this community and this country is about. His prosecutor, Thomas Perez, Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division in the Obama Justice Department, said acts of hate like this one have no place in our country in 2011. And just a reminder, the pipe bomb was, in fact, loaded with lead fishing weights that had been coated in rat poison. He meant to maim. He meant to wound. He meant to kill. And he hoped to kill people with darker skin than his own. And now he is going to spend 32 years in the care, custody, and control of the commissioner of the Department of Corrections, therein to be kept in accordance with law. And segregated from the society, he hoped to, at least in his small part, destroy. Kevin Harpham, enjoy the quiet time and the time away that you have. I don't know if his heart will change. You can rather hope that it might. But at least the people of Spokane, Washington, can rest a little easier. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hey, Jim, what's up?
Well, first, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you and your family.
And to you as well.
By the way, that was Ron Paul and Bruno.
Was it? No, wait. Oh, my God. I thought you were kidding.
No. If, all right.
Yes!
Yes, he was in there, and, you know, I can understand him getting Shannon Doherty in there into his home without any furniture, and so he had these Mexican laborers cleaning his pool, and so they became Mexican chair people, and Shannon Doherty had to sit down on one because these guys were on their knees and backs, and that was those were his Mexican chair people, and he was talking about how, other movie stars had one. They were just totally indispensable. And then,
you can't get along without them.
Right, the Mexican chair people. And he said that Ashton Kutcher and Demi Moore swore by theirs. But nonetheless, it went on, and he has this interview with Ron Paul in his hotel room, and then moves from the sitting room of the hotel room into the bedroom, and Sacha Baron Cohen begins to strip off and make all these provocative comments, and then, only then did Ron Paul realize, this ain't nothing but a bunch of queer shit. And I thought to myself, are you that dumb and stupid that you would be sucked into something like that without knowing what was happening? I mean, if he didn't think it was a setup, I just wonder how close he wanted to get to the actual situation. And then, you know, storms out screaming all of what I just said. So obviously, you know, he isn't particularly what I would call perspicacious or in any way.
Well, you know what, Jim, I think maybe you've earned the evening's first toaster, because this is kind of an indicia that where this is one of those where there's smoke, there's fire kind of things.
Well,
that maybe there was some reality, that maybe he had a little more involvement in those newsletters than maybe folks let on.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, you know, he said, oh, no, I knew nothing about it. But, I mean, they were written under his name, and if he doesn't realize that anything that goes out under your name, you're going to have to take assume responsibility for, my God, I mean, that's just absolutely crazy. I mean, he's saying that he didn't say it, but it went out under his name, right?
Yes, and I mean, if you do a little searching, the stuff that was said there is
terribly inflammatory.
Yeah, well, you know, like the L.A. riots only calmed down when the welfare checks came out, and that the D.C. area of Adams Morgan had become the D.C. zoo.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Listen, Adams Morgan Day is right around Labor Day, and I've been to that several times when I lived in Washington. And basically, Adams Morgan is an extremely diverse neighborhood. Lots of Latinos, lots of people live up there. And it is an incredibly wonderful street fair. I mean, that's the reason it's one of the, you know, if you look at highlights of things in Washington to do, Adams Morgan Day is mentioned there. Is something to, if you're in the city around Labor Day, the weekend around Labor Day, that you are invited to attend and enjoy all the, you know, ethnic foods and things like that. I mean, up toward Adams Morgan, Columbia Road, and off of Connecticut, you know, you have a lot of, Ethiopian restaurants and different types of, restaurants. And, I mean, Adams Morgan is just known for its diversity. And the polyglots of people who live there, and it adds to the richness of the city.
Oh, it's a wonderful area.
Exactly.
Of course, I love D.C. generally, but and it's not too far from DuPont Circle, is it?
No, you go right up. As a matter of fact, you go straight up DuPont Circle up Connecticut, and you veer off, and you go on Columbia Road, and you're right in the middle of Adams Morgan. You just basically get into DuPont Circle by the Metro Red Line, or you can go up Mass Avenue, and it takes you right up into DuPont Circle. If you want to go further, you can go up a couple blocks, and there's the National Cathedral at the corner of Wisconsin and Mass.
Yeah, I know the National Cathedral's up there by Wisconsin Avenue. And you might find this interesting. I just had a quick email letting me know that subsequent to the whole Sacha Baron Cohen Bruno fiasco,
mm-hmm.
Ron Paul told an audience of you know, whatever his little acolytes are called, he told them, I should have punched him. I should have punched him in the face.
Well, if the idiot had any sense, he would have known he was being led into a setup in which he would be made to look like a complete and utter asshole. Excuse my French, but that's the only other way I'd ever describe it. I mean, my cats would have sense enough to be, more sense enough to be led into a setup situation like that, and when he's being filmed.
And, you know, just to give you an idea, I mean, I've mentioned a couple of them, Jim, but just to give you an idea of what went out under Ron Paul's name, here's a quote. We are constantly told that it is evil to be afraid of black men. It is hardly irrational. And then there's this. Given the inefficiencies of what D.C. laughingly calls the criminal justice system, I think we can safely assume that 95% of the black males in that city are semi-criminal or entirely criminal.
And I want to tell you a personal story here. When I lived in D.C., outside my apartment, I dropped my wallet. I mean, it had everything, all types of DOD ID, all types of stuff that you would almost rather commit Harry Carey than lose, okay?
Sure.
And I was just sitting there wondering, fixing to start to call credit card companies and to call the security over to Andrews and stuff like that. And there was a knock at my door. And guess who had my wallet in his hand? A black man. A young black man. Not an older black man with white hair, the Uncle Tom type that people try to portray.
Right.
A young black man. The kind that would be accused of going in your window trying to take your TV.
Well, the kind that Ron Paul says that it's irrational not to fear them.
Exactly. And in the apartment complex in which I lived, it was half black. And I never had any problems with anything whatsoever with these people.
No.
They were kind. They were understanding. They were friendly to me. There weren't any racial problems there.
No, one of my favorite places to go when I'm in D.C. is down off of Thomas Circle. And it's a little basement restaurant and pub. And it's largely persons of color. They pour a mean drink, Jim. I swear they give you about a half a pint of liquor for $6.
Yeah, I know where you are. Been there.
And the food is just awesome. It's just a stone's throw down from the Washington Plaza. And it's one of the more of all the places I've been in D.C. And of course I haven't probably been to nearly as many as you. But it's one of the more pleasant, laid-back, and welcoming places that I've ever been. And yet I guess Ron Paul would just befoul himself with the gut-bending fear at the thought of walking into stands.
Well, you know, it's a strange thing because one day this other lady that I work with, who is whiter than the Queen of England and whiter than my sister, that's basically the way she is. Carol is her name.
I'm going to say, are you asserting there that we're talking about a really, really pale level of whiteness?
Whiteness in mentality and whiteness in skin and just whiteness in her total beliefs and stuff like that. But she and I had to drive over to the Pentagon, and, you know, I said, well, Carol, hell, I'll drive. We'll just go there. And we left Andrews and went down the Suitland Parkway, which takes you right into Anacostia. And she was going on about, oh, I'm scared to be going to Anacostia. I said, well, Carol, we'll just have to be adventurous today. That's all there is to it.
And I can hear you saying it, Jim.
Going off Sterling Fourth Drive, I turned directly onto one of those streets that go right into one of those crack dens.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a black prostitute standing on the side of the road. And so I said, Carol, ask this woman if this is the right, if we've taken the wrong road. And without even getting her permission, I hit the power thing and her window went down. And this lady was just as nice as she could possibly be. I mean, it was true. You could see she was probably out there on the stroll, as they say, but that was all right. And, of course, Carol couldn't even talk. She said, why did you even open the window for that woman? And I said,
that woman.
Exactly, or for that lady. I said, you know, she was not out there to harm you. She was basically on the papers.
Out there to make a living.
Precisely. I said, you know, it's the oldest profession in the world. And I just found out from that experience that, you know, people will treat you the way you treat them. And if you give them attitude, they're going to give you attitude. And it's only natural for them to do so. But I found some of the most decent people in the world in Washington.
Sure.
Well, the white ones, I can tell you that, Bob.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah. You don't have to convince me.
Right. And I can remember when I got this invitation to attend Ron Brown's funeral. Remember the Secretary of Commerce who died
yes.
in the Balkans?
Mm-hmm.
And standing out in front of the National Cathedral, it was a cold April day. And this black woman had a newspaper, and she said, are your feet cold? And I said, ma'am, they certainly are. And she said, well, I have an old trick for you. Put some newspaper inside of your loafers. Because I just worn loafers instead of those old spodgy corduroys that weigh about 10 pounds. But nonetheless, I mean, she was just very nice. And coming back on the metro, I had the program of the funeral in my hand, and there was a black lady sitting next to me. And she saw it, and she just put her hand in mine. She said, you know, that is terrible. And I held hands with the lady.
And obviously you remember it to this day, Jim.
Pardon me, sir?
I said, obviously you remember by remembering it to this day, it had meaning beyond its own moment.
Yeah, and ironically, at the same funeral, I was seated next door to the mayor of Chicago. What's his name, Daley?
Yes.
And I just looked at him and I said, hello, Mayor Daley. And without my even asking him to do so, he grabbed my program and autographed it. And I said, sir, thank you, but I didn't ask for this.
You done wrote on my program. I was going to frame it.
Yeah, I mean, I thought to myself, you know.
Well, I obviously I wasn't there, but I remember that funeral for a different reason, Jim. Because at that time I was doing a lot of traveling. I was on the road quite a bit, and we all know that sort of moth drawn to a flame. I can't resist listening to talk radio, and I cannot tell you how many times that year Rush Limbaugh tried to make political hay out of that funeral. And the way he did it was to say, my friends, I've seen the video of this. Now watch William Jefferson Slick Willie Clinton. He was walking along joking with his friends at the funeral of Ron Brown, but then when he realized the cameras were on him, he became very somber. You see, he's such a phony.
You know, I could have reached out and touched President Clinton and observed him very carefully because he gave the eulogy at the service. And his words were something to the effect that, you know, how fastidious this gentleman was and how, no matter how he tried to dress, that this gentleman, Ron Brown, always looked so much better. Because he had a good physique and he was a very handsome man. And Bill Clinton didn't make any political hay out of that. He was paying homage to a lost member of his cabinet.
It was a sad time.
It was very sad. It was very sad. I mean, the guy had been over in, I think, the Balkans, and he was trying to perform his duties there as directed by President Clinton or whomever. And
the plane went down in fog or something, didn't it?
It was just a real, real, real bad mess. And, you know, I was real surprised to get an invitation to that funeral from the DNC. Of course, back then I was a lot more active with the DNC and stuff like that. And, you know, I didn't make a big deal of it because as a federal employee, you know, you're not supposed to because of the Hatch Act and stuff like that.
Right.
But I asked Colonel Illing, my boss, and she said, you know, Jim, I expected you to be going to this funeral because I know you're a good Democrat, and you certainly could have the day off, and we won't even charge you leave.
That almost sounds like a better and more decent Washington, D.C. Can you imagine something like that happening now?
I don't know, Bob, but I know when I first went to, when the Holocaust Museum first opened up, I was one of the first people there on the day that it opened, and I spent the whole day there. And I brought back cards and stuff like that from it. These are postcards that were drawn by kids who were at Auschwitz and stuff like that. And I had graphics make up a sign in my cubicle saying that hate is not a family value.
You know, that's interesting you would mention that, because I was at a meeting last week when I was away from the microphone. And that is the one of the people that was there had a bumper sticker with that very line on it across his laptop. That's just kind of neat the way these things line up sometimes. And it's the absolute truth. Hate isn't a family value, but the number of people who would tell you that it is are far too many. Like this guy in Washington.
Exactly, and you know the thing about it is. When people saw that in my cubicle, my boss, Colonel Illing, and I didn't realize it, but she was Jewish. And she came up to me and said, you know, I really appreciate your putting this up there. And I wish more people would pay attention to it because there is so much prejudice here. And there is so much anti-Semitism, anti-racial, and this, that, and the other. And, you know, I'm glad you put this up. And, you know, it wasn't a particularly a feel-good moving thing for me, because I had spent the entire day in that museum, and I had sat on those cattle cars and lifted the stones from Van Poison concentration camp and gone through the entire experience. And that's what the Holocaust Museum is. It's more than just going to a museum. It is an experiential situation.
It's immersive.
It's totally immersive. I mean, it was designed that way. And even architecturally, with these walls of steel and bolts and stuff like that, it wasn't made to look like a particularly pretty place. But nonetheless, it was designed to convey a message. And it was designed to commemorate a horrible thing, which hopefully would never happen again. Unfortunately, it has happened in so many ways. I mean, there's
so many places.
There are so many different types of Holocaust that have happened since the Nuremberg trials and stuff like that. And it makes my heart, you know, absolutely break. But nonetheless, sharing those little stories with you, one about Ron Paul being so damn stupid and the other about my positive experiences with black people in Washington, D.C. And, I did play a joke on my father. He was alive then. And he was mayor of the town then. And Marion Barry had gotten into all this trouble with cocaine and stuff like that.
I well remember it.
So I called up, and to these real conservative people, I would call up in different congressmen's offices, and I would ask them to please send pictures of these real conservative friends of mine back in South Carolina dedicated to them. My sister being one. And she was saying, why in the hell am I getting all this stuff from Ted Kennedy or from this, that, and the other? I mean, just to give them a little, it may have been in bad taste, I don't know, but it certainly gave them a run for their money. And I sent one to Marion Barry, and he sent one to my dad, and he said, why is Marion Barry sending me autographed pictures? He said, right now, I'm typing a letter of thank you to him, but please, do not do this anymore.
So, having raised you, he knew the incisive roots that your penchant for the practical joke can take.
Well, I inherited my sense of humor from him, but I mean, I didn't think there was any harm in it, and I just thought, you know, it would be. You know, just a laugh, something to brighten up the day's mail. But nonetheless, you know, it was
Well, and just to take you back to the Ron Paul thing for a moment, with all of these comments that were made in his newsletter, which have been confirmed, Jim, in 1 year to have raked him in a cool $1 million. You know, when he said to Gloria Borger, "I'd like to see it." Well, look in your bank or in your mattress, Congressman Paul, because it's right there. The Texas Monthly was the publication that first sort of investigated and broke the story, and that's when he took quote unquote responsibility for the newsletters. But he also said, and this is the part when Republicans do it that always just slays me. He said certain things were taken out of context.
Taken out of context.
Yeah. Now, how do you? Now, I've got one more of these phrases that appeared in his newsletter, and I'm just itching to find out, Jim. How do you take this out of context? Because this is a quote. He describes in his newsletter Martin Luther King Jr. as, and like I said, this is a quote, the world-class philanderer who beat up his paramours. Then he went on to describe him having seduced underage girls and boys. How do you take that out of context? Or better yet, I suppose, Jim, what is the context in which those words are okay?
Well, that's ridiculous. That's like Hitler saying, oh, everything I said about the Jews was taken out of context, you know? Who was this person that he was referring to as a world-class philanderer? Bill Clinton?
No, Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King?
And by the way, did you get around to seeing J. Edgar? Did you say you had?
No, I haven't seen J. Edgar yet. No, uh-uh.
It was still playing a couple of weeks ago. It's worth your time, and definitely when it comes out on Netflix or comes out on video, it'll be worth your time.
I'm sure it will. I hear Leonardo DiCaprio does a wonderful job.
Magnificent job. Magnificent job. And Naomi Watts. You'd never know it was Naomi Watts. But they can't make her unbeautiful.
And I think Helen Mirren plays his mother.
Not Helen Mirren. Judi Dench.
I mean Judi Dench. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry.
And of course, if she appeared in a movie just long enough to be shown brushing her teeth, she would steal the movie.
Oh yeah, she's a wonderful actress. She really is. But you know, it's really strange that he would try to disavow stuff like that. And who paid him this $1 million for this stuff?
The people that this thing went out to. And this newsletter.
And they believe it, and they accept what he says.
Well, if you get a newsletter saying that. Remember Barbara Jordan, the congresswoman?
Yeah, I sure do.
If you get a newsletter that refers to Barbara Jordan as Barbara Morandan and calls her the archetypical half-educated victimologist, and you put a check in the mail as a result of receiving that newsletter, Jim? I don't think I'm too far afield in suggesting that that's because you agree with that kind of language, am I?
Well, I think you're right on there. I mean, I don't put checks in the mail for anything unless I certainly believe in stuff like that, you know?
I mean, if you put out a newsletter that says, order was only restored in L.A. when it came time for the blacks to pick up their welfare checks, and you get $100 and $10 and $5 contributions back, it's because people agree with that. So how do you, when you, and I guess where I'm trying to go with this, Jim, is that no matter how many times he disavows it or says, I don't know who wrote it, he cashed the checks, Jim.
You know, that type of mentality leads me to believe in one phrase that I heard recently. The North may have won the Civil War, but the South won Reconstruction.
Or
that's something to think about, don't you think?
Yes, it absolutely is. And in many ways, you know, that's part and parcel of the argument that I've made, Jim, that certain parts of this country have never stopped fighting it. They may have stopped shooting, but I grew up with too many of those little cartoony front bumper tags that show the old grizzled Confederate veteran with his star battle flag over his shoulder, and the only thing it says underneath it is, forget hell!
Yeah, you're right. And those old attitudes and those old prejudices and those old hatreds, they just survive from generation to generation because the older generation inculcates the younger generation into subscribing to that, and they want to pass it on. And all they're doing is simply performing a bloodletting operation upon the body politic of their own country when they do it.
Well, absolutely, and that's the thing that's frustrating, because sometimes, and I remember when you yourself have said it, Jim, that there are things that only mortality can cure, that generations simply just have to go the way of all flesh.
Yeah, Khrushchev once said, well, there are certain things only the grave cures. That's the way he dealt with it, yeah.
But in this instance, it is, and I know you must, growing up in South Carolina, you must have witnessed every bit as much of it as I did growing up in Alabama. It is generational. It is handed down from generation unto generation like some precious legacy, so that you can have a 23-year-old kid in Alabama or Georgia or Tennessee or Mississippi or Alabama, South Carolina or whatever, marching up and down reenacting the Battle of Busted Stump and talking about how he reenacts under the Confederate battle flag because it's a matter of legacy, and that war wasn't about slavery, it's about economics.
Oh, bullshit.
You know, which if you've listened to Dr. Bill and Professor Keith, and I know you have, you know, they chapter and verse laid out the origins of the Lost Cause argument as having originated fully 10 years after the close of the Civil War.
Right. Now, you and I don't agree on Robert E. Lee. You know, that's one thing we'll have to disagree on, okay?
I used to be where you are. I used to feel like, you know, noble man, you know, made an ethic, blah, 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 blah. But the more I look at where this country stands, Jim, the problem that I have is that as long as we continue to venerate these secessionists, then secession will somehow itself be legitimized. And I guess that's the biggest thing. I mean, that's my biggest problem.
Robert E. Lee's parole came from, of all people, Ulysses S. Grant.
Yes, it did. Although I once learned that he never actually received his restoration of citizenship papers until after his death.
But I do know this, that at the first Episcopal service, when Robert E. Lee went back to, when he was back in Richmond, penniless and with nothing, and when he first went to the altar to take communion, or when the first black man did, Robert E. Lee was the one who joined him. I think there were a lot of conflicts in Robert E. Lee's mind about that, and I can't judge the man, and I don't believe in, you know, psychoanalyzing dead people, because that's kind of hard to do, but I take a little more lenient attitude towards him than you do, and that's just my position.
I understand that. I just don't, what I don't understand and what I don't, more importantly, don't know, Jim, is how this country is ever going to get over that, how it's ever going to get past it. You know, at the close of apartheid, with all the horrors that had been perpetrated in South Africa, they had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that, and I'm sure I'll get an email saying, oh no, it's still nasty over there, Bob, or something like that, but they made an overt attempt to get past it. It involved immunities from prosecution, and everybody just had to come up and you know, it was a clearing of the air. And we have never to this day had that.
Well, you know, the longest journey begins with the first step, and that's what these people were trying to do over there. But in many situations with people below the Mason-Dixon line, or the cornbread curtain, as you have called it, or it's been called on your show, there are those people who simply don't wish to do that. They wish to keep these things alive. And I have family members that are like that. And I just ask them, you know, does it really give you a feel-good situation to have these attitudes and to engender these hatreds? I said, look at it from a very selfish point of view. You know, hatred and bad feelings, they don't hurt the feeling, the person you're hating. They hurt you, and they detract from your own store of energy and, you know, things that you could devote more positive feelings towards.
Absolutely. And by the way, I should let you know, you got a little fan mail this evening. Our buddy John in New York said, it's great to hear from Jim. I always enjoy his perspectives and his sense of humor. So,
well, Jim has a bizarre sense of humor, and Jim can be real cranky at times, and you know that, and I know that, and I have certain things that I hold.
But who among us cannot?
Well, that's true, and the fact that I'm back on your show and talking to you proves that, you know, I don't hold grudges, and I don't, you know, I respect other people's rights to do things, and if something isn't awry, I'll just tell you so. That's just me, my tip old ornery curmudgeon type of sense of humor. That's just me, and I've heard.
Well, I owe you big time for because at first I thought you were just making a reference, but no, Ron Paul really was in Bruno, and if there's anybody out there worth their salt, they will haul up that scene and start playing it all over Iowa. Of course, I don't know, with Ron Paul running out of the room hollering, "That's a bunch of queers! It's queers, I tell you, queers!" I don't know, that may get him more votes in Iowa.
Well, I don't think so, because, I mean, for him to be as woodenly stupid and as stupidly wooden as to be let into a situation like that in a hotel room, and you'll have to see it. I don't know if you have or not. You'll have to see it.
I will go forth and find it, absolutely. Jim, thank you very much, and a very happy Christmas to you if we don't talk again tomorrow night.
Okay.
All right, take care.
You too.
Bye now. Our buddy Jim, who brings a great deal to bear in the course of our attempts to understand this incredibly strange little world we live in. I just got this video, since we're talking about Ron Paul for some reason or another. I started out trying to talk about that hate-filled rat poisonous bomberins, but I diverted the conversation myself. Just got this video from Sandra, and it's from Meet the Press on December the 23rd, 2007. It's just a minute long, and it is Ron Paul, and this sort of brings together two things that came up in the conversation with Jim. It is Ron Paul discussing the American Civil War. This might be a sit-down-and-strap-in moment. Now, remember, this is Ron Paul who described Martin Luther King Jr. as having seduced little girls and little boys, who said the riots only stopped in Los Angeles because the blacks went to get their welfare checks, who said it is irrational not to be afraid of a black man. Okay, so that's the prologue. Here's the curtain coming up.
Intrigued by your comments about Abe Lincoln. According to Paul, Abe Lincoln should never have gone to war. There were better ways of getting rid of slavery.
Absolutely. 600,000 Americans died in a senseless civil war. No, he shouldn't have gone to war. He did this just to enhance and get rid of the original intent of the Republic. I mean, it was about an iron fist.
We still have slavery.
Oh, come on, Tim. Slavery...
Wait, don't let that one blow by. Because there's a... what a moment that is. Why did Abraham Lincoln go to war? Why did the Civil War happen? This is Abraham Lincoln Ron Paul is talking about.
Absolutely. 600,000 Americans died in a senseless civil war. No, he shouldn't have gone to war. He did this just to enhance and get rid of the original intent of the Republic. I mean,
to enhance and get rid of the original intent of the Republic. Grammarians, you know what we need? We need to appoint an official horn grammarian, because I can't do it on the fly. And we sort of need somebody who can parse this stuff at their leisure and get back with us during the course of the show. I've got a little problem with that phrase.
War, he did this just to enhance and get rid of the original intent of the Republic.
To enhance and get rid of the original intent of the Republic. Which was it, cranky old Doc Paul? Did he want to enhance the original intent of the Republic, or get rid of the original intent of the Republic? Because the two seem, forgive me, and granted I was only a C student in logic, well, I got better, but you can't do both. They seem mutually exclusive to me. You can enhance the Republic, the idea, the original intent of the republic, or you can get rid of the original. No, Abraham Lincoln was Jesus criminy. And this is someone who's in the lead in Iowa? It's another one of those knock on doors in Dubuque. Pardon me, ma'am. Are you a Ron Paul supporter?
Why, yes, yes, I am.
Can I just get your picture?
Hey, what for? What for, Shunny?
Well, I just want to show other people what Ron Paul voters look like. You do know that he hates Abraham Lincoln, right? You do know that he has said awful... Well,
yes, I do know, and it's why I'm going to carcass for him.
There are those moments when you just don't... You feel like you're living in a country that started out as your country and now feels like something out of a Marx Brothers movie. Abraham Lincoln started the Civil War because he didn't like the United States. Because that's what that phrase means. That is sure as God made little green apples what that phrase means.
Civil War... No, he shouldn't have gone to war. He did this just to enhance and get rid of the original intent of the republic. I mean,
Abraham Lincoln was an anti-constitutionalist. Oh, Timmy Russert, you tosser of softballs! How I wish you would have followed up and said, so you're glad he got assassinated, Congressman Paul? Or can we say that's a good thing? But no, Timmy Russert never did any of that kind of stuff.
It was about iron fist.
We still have slavery.
Oh, come on, Tim. Slavery was phased out in every other country of the world, and the way I'm advising that it should have been done is do like the British Empire did. You buy the slaves and release them. How much would that cost compared to killing 600,000 Americans?
But who would buy them, Ron? You're a freaking libertarian! It'd be unconstitutional for the government to buy the slaves and set them free. Under your view of the Constitution, the government wouldn't even have the power to do that. So are we to understand that Ron Paul thinks everything from waging war to paving roads is unconstitutional? But if he, as president, decides that he wants to spend money doing, buying all the slaves and freeing them like England did, that would have been constitutional because he said so? That's not a nation of laws and not of men. That is rule by dictatorial autocratic fiat. And yet all over this country, Ron Paul didn't want us to go to Iraq. That must mean he's a progressive and a liberal and he believes in peace and Jesus Christ, somebody get out the tambourine and the harmonica and the guitar and let's play Kumbaya. Ah! And what makes me even crazier is that there are some on what we call our side of this debate who are saying that crap. Well, he hated the war just like Dennis Kucinich did, therefore he must be just... No, he's not! Dennis Kucinich is an enlightened man. Ron Paul has the enlightenment of a fire plug. With the water turned off. Because it's unconstitutional to have fire plugs in Ron Paul world. Unless the free market owns the fire plugs, of course, then it's perfectly that. Well, yes, that's wonderful.
And where it lingered for 100 years. I mean, the hatred and all that existed. So every other major country in the world got rid of slavery without a civil war. I mean, that doesn't sound too radical to me. That sounds like a pretty reasonable approach.
You're running it as a...
Jesus. Honest to God. It's too early to put the straw in the tequila bottle. Jim just did some quick on-the-fly research. Now, bear in mind, the number that you're about to hear is in 1861 dollars, not 2011 dollars that are pumped out by the Fed, and we've got to close the Fed, and where's my milk of magnesia? These are 1861 dollars. I don't even know how you would convert them to 2011 dollars. I'll leave that to the folks with that skill set in the economics world. But Jim, doing some research on the fly, noting it would have cost $11 billion with a B dollars to have purchased the manumission of all the slaves in the United States. $11 billion. Jesus, do we even have a word for the number set that that would be? In, I mean, because it's got to be more than trillions.
Oh, but then we could have invaded Mexico and just taken the gold, and we would have been on the gold standard like Jesus wants us to be, and we could have paid for it, and you know, a thin silver dime would buy you a slave in 18...
Shut up, Ron Paul. Libertarian gynecologist. I'm rich. I'm comfortably well off. David in Tennessee noting, sadly, the preserving the mythic South... David named the subject of this post. Sadly, there's a 40-year-old that had been told for his or her first 7 to 8 years of life, racism was a good thing. Well, having not heard it from age 7 to age 30, these people began to hear those ugly ideas in an amped-up form at age 31. They had their chance again. They heard it from Flush, from Hannity. They heard Toby Keith talking about putting boots in posteriors, the sources of the horrid reintroduction of racism are manifold in this country, and it is done under the guise of freedom of speech. There will come a time when speech in this country becomes so abused that notions of freedom of speech will go away. And it will be because of the Hannitys and the Flemballs and the Savages and the Bortzes and the Becks. Because it is possible to abuse the freedom of speech. And to do so, well, note what Judge Justin Quackenbush said in Washington. That a man was moved to coat fishing weights in blood-thinning rat poison, pack them into pipe bombs, put those into a backpack, and leave it to detonate upon a group of innocent parade participants. That he was inspired to do that by right-wing hate radio. And sooner or later, somebody besides me is going to point out the fact that that is the 21st century equivalent of yelling fire in a crowded theater. That sending arguably unstable or semi-stable individuals with little education and lots of free time and motivation out to do in the enemies, the them that they hear about every day when they turn on their radio and hear things broadcast over the airwaves that you and I own, we the people. Someday somebody else is going to figure out that that is, in fact, a straight-up abuse of the First Amendment. But then how many times have I noted that the First Amendment is little more than a life support system for the religion industrial complex, because it is. Anybody figured out what $11 billion would be in 2011? I can hardly stand to contemplate the thought. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Sandra.
Hey, yeah, no, that figure, you know, there's a formula to figure out what money was any factor in inflation, but I don't really have it off the top of my head. You know, it's one of them problems that you do, and you're like, oh, God, you don't ever want to do again. So.
Well, I mean, $11 billion in 1861 would be just zeros across the room now, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah, it'd be a lot. Well, actually, you know, a slave is cheaper today. Human slaves are like a fraction today of what they cost in antebellum America. I don't know if you know that.
Yes, well,
it's like if you paid $1,500 for one, the equivalent now would be $90. I remember reading that in one of these developmental economic books. You know, it's shocking.
Well, and that goes hand in hand with the fact that there are more African Americans in our prison system now than actually were alive at the end of the Civil War.
Yeah, but anyway, I thought that video was really telling because he's not even making any sense. It's like, well, wait a minute. You're not going to have the government doing any kind of operation like that. It doesn't fit your worldview, Mr. Paul. You see what I mean? It was just absurd listening to that. It's like, you're not going to, you wouldn't in any way condone the government buying people to settle a conflict. He's full of shit. His shit was well exposed in that video. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, wow.
I don't think I've ever seen a better exposure of his hypocrisy.
Yeah, no, that was outrageous. It was just like, what are you talking about? I looked at that and I thought, oh, yeah, you know, I know Bob's gonna like that. Because it's just, it just says everything. He's absurd. And if you couple that with, you know, his like, oh, my God, the white people are just realizing that he's racist shit that's going on right now. Because I'm laughing. I'm like, oh, come on. You going to bring this up again? You know, I mean, anybody with any sense.
But the thing that was new to...
You know that he's racist. I mean, as a... I'm sorry, just on the strength of who he is and who he's related to and where he's from, I'm taking it as a given. His generation and stuff. And it may be wrong on my part, and I forgive old white people in their 70s, but that's just, you know, a quick observation right there. Because...
Now, the one thing that I didn't know or had never read was that he made a cool million off of that filth,
well,
Sandra.
Well, no, and you make a good point. No one's saying that, you know, did he say that, oh, he'd never seen that money now? Isn't that what he's saying, though?
Yeah, that's what he said to Gloria Borger.
Right.
Borger.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the thing is, though, but, you know, what he said, you know, it just rings too true. I don't care if he didn't write it, but his the people he run with, that Lou Rockwell? Are you kidding me with that guy? Come on now.
And he worked for Ron Paul, right?
Right. I know. You know, it's like, who cares who you ascribe it to? They're all part of your peeps. And people are bringing it up now because, unfortunately for Ron Paul, his politics are running against the neocons and the security state apparatus. They're not going to have him. So they'll dig up whatever. And these naive 30-something white people and younger who are all infatuated at Ron Paul, I mean, they disgust me.
Oh, I thought Malloy was going to have a fit lecturing them the other night, bless his heart.
Yeah, no. But it's, I mean, because I don't, you know, a libertarian ain't worried about what I do with my uterus. You understand what I'm saying? So right there, I'm like, what's up? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He seemed to be real concerned about that. And he's racist. I mean, it's just like too many things are sort of pushing against that, quote, libertarian streak. It's BS. That's what that is.
Well, you can't be a libertarian and think that Martin Luther King's national holiday is Hate Whitey Day.
Well,
because
yeah.
If you're a civil libertarian, you ain't supposed to be no racist.
Well, no, but also, this is the same person who's talking about, you know, some sort of buyback scheme for chattel. It's like, oh, my God. So, you know, everything that comes out of his mouth is sounding really dubious. And if you stack it all together, it equals racist.
Well, get this, Sandra. Michael
in the closet.
Exactly. Michael in Sebastopol just wrote in, and he did some quick intertubing. And he said, according to the Internet, the 1860 total United States federal budget was about $260 million.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Okay. So now, we're in the realms of outer space again with what the value is, which is why they went to war. You understand what I'm saying? It all just plays in. It's like, yeah, damn Skippy, I'm not giving up them Negroes. Pow. you know.
Yeah, let's shoot at that. Hey, look, there's a convenient federal fort out in the harbor. Let's take pot shots at it.
And to me, it just sort of reaffirms why the war was so brutal. That's a lot of money. That's a lot, giving up a lot. So, yeah, that's what people go to war for. He tripping. And the whole thing with England giving up their slaves. I mean, come on now. Once again, we run smack into the wall of there is no cohesion in America outside of the almighty green. So anytime you have divisions up in this mug, it gets real nasty. That's why I'm scared of where we're heading with now. This ain't Japan. There is no cohesion.
Well, you know, it was a couple of nights ago, Sandra, when we were talking about Birmingham, Alabama. I learned a little something else about Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, okay.
You're going to love this. Because the people, and I admit, I heard it on NPR, but the people who were in charge of putting together this story said the problem with what I'm about to describe is that there are no statistics on it being used because no one is aware of anybody else doing it. The city of Birmingham put the Birmingham Police Department into every high school in Birmingham. And in the course of a relatively short period of time, 100 children have been sort of, arbitrarily pepper sprayed. They're pepper spraying Birmingham high school students. The story that they used to illustrate it was a young woman who was being insulted by a high school student who was male, and she got very upset and she was crying, and the hall cop came up to them and said, "Miss, you're going to have to calm down and stop being hysterical," and then hosed her down with pepper spray. And so the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, has filed a suit that it hopes will be turned into a class action suit to stop this stuff.
Well,
but isn't this hand in hand with a collapse? I mean, I know you and I kind of hammer on this, and probably me more than you, Sandra, but isn't this just indicia? Isn't this just evidence of what collapsing culture looks like?
Well, no, but and also it's just sort of, you know, the expansion of what I call containment. Because when I used to live in Oak Park, which is a predominantly black area in Sacramento, you know, I was always struck by how the police don't really police. They just kind of contain. And that seems to be the way they operate when they're around people of color, if I may put it politely.
Well, needless to say, the young woman was of color, as was the young man.
Right. And so when you decide to turn our brutal, historically brutal police force into institutions where they didn't used to be, oh, shock, horror. All of a sudden you got kids arrested, sprayed, shot, hit, and all sorts of other shit that goes on when you have to deal with the pigs one-on-one.
Oh, I know. Susie, what did you learn in school today? I learned when the officer says for me to quit crying, I better quit crying or I'm going to get pepper sprayed.
Well, and that's just, you know, especially for kids, you know, of color. And when you shouldn't have police like that in the schools. The schools aren't there for that. And all the schools are becoming militarized. That's one of Arnie Duncan's main thing. He's really quite keen on, you know, making these poor schools, especially, you know, reflect some sort of military ethics. So, you know, it's the fine line between prison and school. It's all blurry.
And what they offered as a sort of sidebar to the Birmingham story is the fact that on January 1st, the entire school system of Kansas City will be disaccredited, and it has financial ramifications. It has obviously educational ramifications, and the thing is, they've had all of those free market miracles there. They've had their charter schools. They've had means of putting children from failing schools into successful private academies, and you know, look what it's brought about.
Well, all it's going to continue to bring about is the destruction of public schools in this country. I mean, you know, once again, with no sense of history, we didn't used to have public schools. You know how in America everyone always thinks that as things are, they always were in this country? You know that problem?
Oh, yes.
Okay, well, we didn't used to have no fucking public schools. That was a social engineering, you know, at its best, I may add. So as it goes, it can go away again. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm really done with this kind of, like, these institutions are here forever. No, if they're not nurtured and taken care of and paid for, well, they're going to go bye-bye and replaced by whatever corporate predator is waiting in the wings.
And
that's how it works.
Yeah, because before there were public schools, there were religious schools.
Well, and there were basically no schools.
Right.
I mean, that's what I'm trying to get at, is that the majority of the people didn't have access to. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, Abraham Lincoln came into this discussion. That's the Abraham Lincoln story. He had no school. He walked how many miles to borrow and return books and sat there reading them by firelight? That's a determination to learn, but it's also a reflection of someone who has the leisure time to do it. Now, on the other hand, when the minute you're old enough to carry the bag, you're out in the field with mama chopping cotton, well, you know what? I don't care if you walk 15 miles to get them. You're not going to have any time for teaching yourself to read by the fireplace. And so there is an inherent element to that suggests that some people in this country are worth educating and others are not.
And when you combine that with the deindustrialization, then the powers that be are like, well, we don't want these people to have education. So you have to factor that in, too. None of this stuff is on accident or as haphazard as it may look.
Look at the school system, and I don't know maybe if your nieces will be coming up against this when they start high school out there where you are. But we've had four kids now go into ninth grade at the same high school, and in ninth grade they are told to pick a career track, and the course of their coming 4 years of education in the high school are determined by the career track that a 13-year-old chooses. And so, you don't need to write that good to be a coal miner, or, well, you don't need that much science if you're going to be an artiste.
Or those programs they track in Chicago and Detroit where they, you know, got Walmart sponsoring it. You know where them kids are going to end up.
Hell yeah.
And then, you know, I guess, your kids, they have you and Agnes to sort of hopefully point them to the right curriculums, but not all 13-year-olds have that sort of advantage, you know, and have to make that decision right there. Yeah, that's a bit much.
And it bothers me with and I have massive frustrations with this school system because it's only gotten worse since our school system was declared to be a failure by the State Department of Education. Dropout rates have gone up, absenteeism's gone up, grades have gone down, teen pregnancy's gone up, violence in the schools has gone up, as we have witnessed personally.
Wow.
And so it consequently bears gravely upon my mind when I find myself going hammer and tongs at them, because I feel like I'm playing right into the hands of the corporatists and the people who don't believe in education. Because it's hard for me to look at the way the public schools are being run, at least here where I am, and say, well, you know, this is a rousing success. But I get the sense that it is a designed failure, and it goes back to, you know, poor old Teddy Kennedy, God or whomever rest his soul, being hoodwinked into participating with George Bush in that godforsaken No Child's Behind Left program. Because
no,
that set up every public school in this country to potentially become a failure.
No, those programs are just horrific, you know, because I don't know what my nieces were asking me today about, and I was trying to explain to them, well, you know, that when I was their age, I remember my teacher, every teacher had their own curriculum, and they just couldn't even wrap their head around, you know, the no worksheets or no open court or all these other sort of corporate leading programs that the kids are saddled with today, you know, I mean... my third grade teacher, if you act up, next thing I know, I was sitting there copying the dictionary. I mean, everybody had their own way back then.
I would have rather had the beaten. You don't know how much dictionary I copied.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, Yeah, it was a whole different setup when we were coming up. I don't remember any kind of, you know, handouts or sort of established anything. You know what I mean? So just that in itself, and that's a couple of generations ago, it's changed so dramatically how the kids are being educated. And I shake my head. I'm like, wow, I don't even know how these kids are supposed to have any critical skills at all. You know?
Well, and I don't want to use my kids as examples. It's kind of unfair to them because they're not here to defend themselves. But we were looking into some grade issues and looking, and because one of my kids just took the state benchmark exam for 10th grade biology.
Mm-hmm.
And placed like second in the state. Okay? Well, this particular child of mine has periodically been not doing well at all in 10th grade biology. And we went in, we sat down with the teacher, and we said, you know, why is this? And, well, and it turns out that there are elements they have to teach according to standards that are set, and one of the standards is that you have to have group work.
Well, yes, yeah, I don't know what the, you know, I don't, every state has their own standards, but you know, have you had a chance to look at the standards for your state?
Yes.
Okay, good, because, you know, you can...
And every class has to have an element, a certain amount of class time that's devoted to breaking into, like, small groups and learning that way. The only problem is if kid A busts her butt, kid B... kind of mails it in, and kid D just says, screw it, I ain't doing nothing, and the average group score winds up being a D, the whole group gets the D. And I don't know what are you trying to teach? Because it obviously is not the subject that you're trying to teach. It's something about, what, human psychodynamics, Sandra?
If they were concerned about the group dynamic, they would have to sort of lay out the proper way of engaging in group dynamics for it to be a success. Otherwise, it's going to fail every time. It's a real skill to work in a group. You see what I mean? And it's no wonder that, I mean, I don't know. You know, that doesn't really make, that's quite difficult to do. And especially if you're the one doing all the work, and you're how old? 15, please.
Yeah.
You ain't about to.
And you get handed the D. And
yeah.
Yeah. Why not just say screw this and walk away?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't. You know, like I'm always inclined to be sympathetic to the teaching professor, the teacher.
Yeah, me too.
They know what they have to go through, and it's, you know, they're just sort of between a rock and a hard place at this point, because the sort of standards that they're required to present to the students, wow. I mean, it doesn't leave much room for their own professional development.
And,
you know, what I
and
mean?
You know, God help you, why do you have art class? Why do you have speech class? Because you know what? You can't put questions about speech or art or even really band or drama or journalism on a standardized test. And, of course, whether it be West Virginia or California or anywhere, Texas or anywhere in amongst and between, everything is about the standardized test.
Well, that's, I mean, that's bizarre that your girl scored. I mean, I don't understand. What, you know, that seems problematic. If she is able to master their state standard tests and still struggling in the actual class, it's usually the other way around.
But what that shows us is that the student is able to comprehend the material and hand the material back, so to speak, but that the lollygagging and fripperies, that maybe the student's not so good at those.
Which
goes back to something that I've argued and I've talked to Dr. Bill at some length about. We've got all these people out there who revere, and God knows we've been guilty of it, but I think we're also a little more realistic in our conversations on the horn. Revere the founders and the framers and the Enlightenment geniuses, and you can never overestimate that, who pulled this country together, and yet we have no interest in educating our children the way that these people we revere were educated. And I find that kind of mind-boggling.
Well, yeah, I mean, the U.S. system, you know, has taken a lot from Prussia, which I think is where public education had its origin, but that system there was also there to placate and mollify the students, too. That has to be remembered.
Right, to keep them from chopping any heads off and stuff when they get older.
Yeah, that was a reason. I mean, you know, the system was admirable in some aspects, but it definitely did have a purpose of mollification. But anyway.
But, it, you know, it's like David in Tennessee kind of reminds us both. He just said a minute ago, the folks that want it all want the following. For-profit schools, for-profit prisons, for-profit everything. And just as a reminder, they want it all. And this is what it looks like when you see them getting their way in wanting it all.
Well, and also, which, you know, I mean, I haven't really seen this sort of, you know, all these people are talking about the loss of civil liberties and whatnot. They don't seem to be making the connection, at least which I'm making with it, is that forget the war on terror. I just think it's an apparatus being set up to deal with, you know, the coming economic collapse. I don't mean that it's all at once, but just the restructuring of our economic life in that you're going to have people never working and 30% reduction in wages.
And just, well, let me just put this question to you, because you and I are of the same age, and we experienced different sections of the country in somewhat similar fashion. What is it about a successful middle class and towns with little local businesses on their main street and schools that functioned? What is it about that that our betters hate? And why is it that they do hate it? And why is it that it has to be converted to this system that I think you're right in describing, Sandra, but I fail to understand?
Well, because it goes back to what you were saying before about people wanting it all. I mean, you know, let's not forget that the boom period for white people after World War II up until about 75 was an abnormality in history. What we have going now and going forward is more in line with what exists in the world. You know, small numbers of people who are affluent and large numbers of people who have nothing. So this sort of booming middle class that America developed, you know, was an abnormality in history, and it served this country really well. But there's always been the vultures on the top. And for some reason in 1980, everyone sort of lost their minds in this country and decided to revisit the teens. I don't even know what else to say.
Well, I think about it in context with, like, Prop 13 out in California.
Well, yeah, and if you keep that in mind, yet the people voted against lowering their taxes in California, if you can imagine that. They ran this shit for years. It wasn't overnight. But every time people would say, no, we don't want our taxes lowered. So it was, you know, it was a slow process that seems to fall in line with the idea of when the generation dies off that suffers, you get the repeal of Glass-Steagall. You understand what I'm saying by that?
Yeah, I do. It's that
they're not around anymore.
Yeah, it's that failure of transgenerational wisdom. It's
right.
The stuff that didn't get passed along. It's the grandmothers who never sat with their little 7-year-old granddaughters and said, "Honey, never again."
Right, so I believe that. I think that especially for a sort of invented project or whatever like we have here. So, you know, it seems to make sense that it would all unravel because it's, you know, it's been a good 80 years, you know what I mean, between when it was a complete misery here for the vast majority of people.
And yeah, not...